Right, so the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee is called to order. Good afternoon, everyone. Glad to have you here. We're going to remind all the participants here to please mute your feeds and for members to use the raise your hand function if you'd like to ask a question. Just as a reminder, today we are extending the time of this hearing, so we will be going until 5:30 this afternoon. So we're going to start with the roll call. And Ms. Niedernhofer, if you're ready, please call the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
The quorum is present.
All right, thank you. So, quorum being present, the first order of business is to approve the minutes of February 8th. And Representative Pryor?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pryor moves approval of the minutes of February 8th. Any discussion to the minutes? If members would please unmute yourselves. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, so we are starting today, members, with a presentation on masks from the Department of Health. And so let me just kind of lay out the day for you a little bit so that you, before we get started on the presentation. So we're going to get a background presentation, and we're going to hear from three presenters. We've got Dan Huff from the Department of Health. We have Chris Hogan, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota. And we have Dr. Ann Griffiths, a respiratory and critical care specialist. So I'm excited to hear what they have to say. And then we will hear a bill on this topic after we get through the presentation. So you will have an opportunity to ask questions after the presentations. So I would ask members to please hold your questions until we get through the presentation. Of course, unless there's something that you need answered immediately, like what does that acronym mean or something like that. So with that, Mr. Huff is going to get started and welcome. And I assume you're going to put up some slides for us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Dan Huff. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. And I believe, Lisa, are you presenting slides for me today? If we can get those slides up.
Are they not showing? I'm trying to share my screen.
There we go.
Okay, hold on.
Not quite.
That's your email.
Yep, we're all reading your email here.
There it is. Fantastic.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, next slide, please. So just wanted to talk about how respiratory diseases are spread. So COVID or SARS-CoV-2 is a virus that causes COVID, is a respiratorily spread virus. Now, this picture is a wonderful illustration of what happens and coming out of our mouth. But obviously, that's during a sneeze. Even when we're just breathing, water droplets, very small water vapor, which are just small droplets, come out of our mouth. You know, you go out on a day like today and you can see the vapor that we breathe out, whether we're just breathing, we're talking, it comes out of our nose, it comes out of our mouth. And all of these little water droplets, if I'm infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus will hitch a ride on these water droplets and they'll float in the air a little while. And then if someone else were to breathe them in, then those viruses hitching a ride on those droplets can get down into the lungs and then infect the other person. Now that's dependent upon how much virus am I emitting? How much virus are they sucking in? And then how vulnerable they are. How good is their immune system to fighting that initial onslaught? We do know that with enough virus, most people will become infected. And this virus is a highly infectious one. Next slide, please. Now, SARS-CoV-2 and the disease that it causes, COVID, is a very serious disease. Now, we know that there are many people that can have the disease and are asymptomatic. They seem to have very little of any effect from having infection. However, many people are not so lucky. And we do know that people die of the disease, but there are many people that have actually some pretty severe complications. The reason is that the disease attacks what are called ACE2 receptors. These are receptors found on some cells in the body. Now, the respiratory lining has a lot of these ACE2 receptors, but ACE2 receptors are found in our nervous system. They're found lining our arteries, which means that people have heart attacks, they have strokes from COVID, this weird thing called COVID toes, where you get these kind of bluish, like almost bruised toes. It impacts the nerves, so you may get encephalitis, brain damage. The kind of common symptom you've heard of, that weird thing where people lose their sense of smell and taste, that's because it is attacking the olfactory nerve. So it actually is a sort of a weird disease, but it also can be quite significant. We've heard the term of long haulers. People have this brain fog because of the nervous system impacts of the disease. Next slide. Masks are important because what they do is they intervene as I breathe out those droplets of water that may be laden with the virus. The mask redirects them, it traps them, and it lowers their velocity. Professor Hogan will talk more about how that works mechanically. But what we know is my mask helps protect you. It also protects me. And that if you and I are both wearing a mask when we're near each other, we are significantly reducing the spread of the disease and that possibility. So the more people that wear a mask, the greater the benefit. Next slide. And it's well documented that masks are effective in reducing the spread of COVID. Just last year, one of the things about a novel virus, brand new, we had to do a lot of study on this, and there have been some excellent studies done throughout the world, published in peer-reviewed journals, that have shown that, yes, indeed, masks are effective in reducing the spread of the disease and the virus that causes it. Next slide. Here's just a little chef sampler of some of those studies. You may remember very beginning in the pandemic back last March, the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier had a major outbreak. One of the things that they found is that servicemen and women who wore masks had a much lower rate of infection. So 55.8% versus an 80.8% of those who were not wearing masks. So that shows that the masks are actually protective of the wearer. Over in that right column, Tennessee counties, they actually looked at counties that had a masking ordinance and those that did not, found that those that had a masking ordinance had much slower spread. What's important, lower hospitalization for COVID. Internationally, if you look at that bottom right, Germany, a very similar thing for regional mandates. Mask wearing reduced the number of COVID infections by 45%. So really, you know, in many situations, in many different types of environments, in different countries, in different states, the research has shown that masking is effective. Next slide, please. Just even a recent study just published. In fact, it's not even published. The manuscript has been accepted for publishing. A recent study that shows in the United States, looking at states that had, were they an early adopter, a mid adopter, or later never adopter. And those that were early adopters of masking fared much better than the late and never, and those that were late adopters did better, but not quite as well as the early, but still better than the never adopters. Next slide. I'd like to turn it over now to Professor Hogan to talk some about the engineering of aerosols and some of the fascinating work that he and his colleagues have done. Professor Hogan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hello, Professor Hogan. Thank you for being with us. We really appreciate your time. And if you would just give us a brief state your name and where you're from, and then go ahead. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Hogan. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota. My research for the past 18 years has been in aerosol science, the study of particles and droplets in gaseous suspensions. And I'm the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Aerosol Science since 2019, which is the premier journal for aerosol research. If we can go to the next slide, please. So as Dan mentioned, we are constantly exhaling aerosol particles and droplets. We're actually exhaling millions of these throughout the day. And this has been known for some time that we are exhaling these particles, and they have been concerned in infection. I can point out a study that was published approximately 10 years ago in the journal I edit, Johnston et al. This is out of the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, that actually painstakingly measured these particles and droplets from volunteers in a clean room that was particle-free. And they were able to highlight two modes of these particles and droplets. One, if we look at the graph on the right, which was centered around 100 micrometers, and these were large water droplets. They're slightly smaller than what we can make out with the eye, but from an aerosol perspective, these are quite large, and they will gravitationally fall to the ground on a second time scale. Meanwhile, there was a second mode centered around a micrometer, and these would be called aerosols. These particles will not gravitationally settle out on a reasonable time scale. They will stay in the air for hours. They won't deposit very efficiently on surfaces as well. They really are only removed from the air once we clear them. There's a growing body of evidence from a number of studies that these small particles can contain infectious viruses, infectious respiratory viruses, in particular SARS-CoV-2. And so we need to look for measures to protect ourselves from inhalation, not only of droplets, which we can certainly inhale, but also of these small aerosols, which don't clear due to gravity. So if we go to the next slide, please. So masks are a potential way to do this. I want to talk a little bit about how masks collect both aerosols as well as large droplets. We want to talk about this not just for protecting yourself, but protecting others from the aerosols that you may be emitting. So if we look at mask collection of particles, and we talk about these larger particles and droplets, well, the reason that these masks collect them is simply because the particles are too large to bend around the mask. They can't bend around like the flow. They will inertially impact or be intercepted. And so if we look at this qualitative graph on the right, and this is roughly how masks would behave in terms of their collection efficiency. So the y-axis here, the vertical axis, would be collection efficiency. The largest droplets are really collected by any mask, an N95 respirator, a surgical mask, a cloth mask, even a poorly fitting mask that we believe leaks will collect our largest particles and droplets. They'll also do a pretty good job in the most part for our smallest aerosol particles. And this would be smaller than 100 nanometers or even smaller than COVID. And that's because these little particles wiggle around by a process called diffusion, and they eventually bump into the mask. And so there is in the middle a collection efficiency minimum at about 300 nanometers to about a micrometer, where masks may or may not do a good job in collection. The N95 respirator that you've no doubt heard of has an excellent collection efficiency even at its minimum. In fact, its minimum collection efficiency is 95%, where it gets its name. Surgical masks will still collect about 76% of these particles. Cloth masks or poorly fitted cloth masks may not collect particles in this size range very efficiently. However, all masks can still provide excellent source control. And the reason for that is when we exhale these small aerosols, they're not at this 1 micrometer or smaller size yet. They're actually much larger. They only get small after evaporation. So masks are an excellent way to collect particles that we are emitting as the mask wearer, and they can be a good way to collect them from particles that are out in the environment. They can protect us and they can protect others from us. If we go to the next slide. So I've had the opportunity to be a consultant with the Mayo Clinic Division of Engineering, who's actually been studying this for the past 6 months and has a study which is in going through the peer review process, which they've allowed me to share some of the results of. Mayo was interested in looking at the effects of a variety of masks as well as distance between individuals who were interacting with one another for a short time period, say 3 minutes. So a very quick conversation in a hallway, passing by one another in the supermarket, what would the effect of wearing a mask be? And they looked at this for three different scenarios. One, of course, having no mask on either individual, and these individuals were represented by respiratory mannequins. One was the source exhaling 2 micrometer particles. The other was the target inhaling these 2 micrometer particles, and we're looking at how many the target inhaled. So we looked at a no mask case, a mask just on the source, a mask just on the target, as well as a mask on both the source and the target, and quantified the differences in exposure to the target as a function of distance between the two individuals, going from 1 foot to 6 foot. And so if we take a look on slide 12, I believe we can show some of the results of this study. So if we go to the next slide. What we can see is the following. If we look at the bar in the upper left, we have something that says the 1 foot distance, no mask. And we'll use that as our baseline. That's 100% exposure, neither is mask. So this is a high level of exposure. As we increase to 3 foot and 6 foot distance, our exposure certainly does reduce, even in the absence of masking. But if we take a look just at the 1 foot distance, if we go from the top left down one, and we say the source is masked. Notice it doesn't matter what kind of mask we're talking about. It could be a disposable cloth mask or a fabric mask. Our exposure is already reduced more than being 6 foot apart just by having that source mask. And that stays true at the 3 foot distance and the 6 foot distance. We can really reduce exposure by all remaining masked to one another. Target masking also protects the wearer to some extent, and both masked is the ideal. If we can play the video. This is a smoke test that we're looking at, and what you'll see is the smoke test for a variety of masks. The smoke in this case is very dense. It's also extremely small particles, around 100 nanometers or smaller. It's just meant to be a physical tracer. You will notice the particles are certainly leaking out, are they not? But what I want to show is that for all of the masks, there is no penetration of this plume out farther than a foot from the person. The mask doesn't just collect particles. Even for things that can get through, it acts as a diffuser. It blunts the flow, if you will. This is extremely important in short-term encounters. It makes sure that we're not directly exposed, and it gives us time for our ventilation systems to work. That is, it keeps the particles away from us until we can clear them through ventilation. If you can jump ahead in the video to about the 50-second mark, you can actually see a comparison. Here it is. That's the jet you will see in a moment when no mask. This is the exact same flow rate. These are representative of what a person can exhale with a big breath. That's what we're doing to one another without a mask. And then in the presence of the mask, which should be added one more time, I believe, at the end of the video, we can actually see that what we're doing is preventing flow from penetrating out. So masks provide this collection capability, and they also provide this flow blocking capability. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hogan. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to continue.
Sure, let's go ahead. Are we ready for Dr. Griffith?
Almost. Griffiths?
Okay.
And you have a couple more slides. Okay. Just on masking in general, to make sure that masks achieve the most effective use, we want to make sure that they fit both over the nose and the mouth. You know, we are breathing out of our nose, and that is projecting particles, so it does need to be over the mouth. And it should be, you know, fit securely. And as Professor Hogan showed, in addition and used with social distancing is when we get the maximum in. Next slide, please. So we want to use a breathable fabric that's tightly woven. Cotton can be good. We want it to be two or three layers. Some people have masks where they can put like a coffee filter in, and that adds a disposable filter in that increases the effectiveness of the mask. We do not want to have a mask with a valve. A valved mask actually just provides like a hole when you breathe out. It's protective for you when you're breathing in because the valve is closed, but it is not protecting other people because you're actually just projecting it right through that hole, which is the valve. Next slide. There's lots of different masks. You may have heard of the N95, as Professor Hogan mentioned. N95 is actually a respirator. And we're not talking about that here because it is personal protective equipment. To be used effectively, a respirator has to be fit tested and used by trained personnel. We also still globally have a shortage of N95 masks, and we have prioritized those who are directly caring for sick individuals, or medical care providers, first responders, et cetera. Next slide. Chair Reedman, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Griffiths.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Hogan, thank you. That was really interesting. So Dr. Griffiths, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you would just state your name.
Hi there. I'm Ann Griffiths. I'm a pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Respiratory and Critical Care Specialists, as well as Children's Minnesota and Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. Madam Chair and members, thank you for having me today.
Please go ahead.
Okay. As I mentioned, I'm a pediatric pulmonologist. I'm also the director of the Primary Ciliary Dyskinesia Center at Children's Minnesota and a member of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention e-cigarette or vaping-associated lung injury response clinical working group. I provide medical care for children with a range of lung diseases spanning from mild asthma and episodic abnormal behaviors of breathing to conditions that cause scarring in the lungs like cystic fibrosis and primary ciliary dyskinesia, as well as those who rely on tracheostomies and ventilators at home to breathe. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. Fortunately, thus far, children have had a low likelihood of severe or debilitating disease associated with COVID-19. And while the severe cases will stand out in the minds of those of us who have cared for them in the ICU, the hospital, and the rehab unit, children rarely appear to seek care alone. Our most medically fragile children are surrounded by many caregivers, both professional and family members. We know that a significant number of cases of COVID-19 are passed from adult to child, and that COVID can also spread from child to caregiver. Furthermore, data suggests that many people transmit the disease when they either do not have symptoms, do not yet have symptoms, or when they were too mild to have been noticed. The CDC and AAP support masks to help decrease transmission of COVID-19. And at Children's Respiratory and Critical Care Specialist, Children's Minnesota, and Gillette's Children's Specialty Healthcare, we follow approximately 12,000 children and young adults with lung disease. Our lung and ICU doctors support the use of masks. Our patients have tolerated masks well, with few exceptions. In fact, many of our patients with severe lung disease, such as those with advanced cystic fibrosis, have worn masks for years. We encourage families to practice mask wearing together so that children can get used to how it feels to breathe through a mask. It does feel different. Some of our medically fragile children cannot use masks, and we aim to protect them as well, and source protection is important. We've seen their success in combination with hand hygiene and social distancing and keeping our doctors, nurses, and respiratory therapists and other healthcare workers safe at the hospital, and our successes at in-person school environments. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We really appreciate it. And I know that Dr. Griffiths has to can only be with us, I think, until 3:45. So we want to be respectful of her time, but I know that members may have questions. And I thought I saw Representative Pryor. I'm sorry, I've been having a little technical difficulty here, so the staff is having trouble giving me the list of people speaking. But I think we're good now. So I think I saw Representative Pryor. I'm going to call on you first, and then I see Hewitt and Bierman. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, I think it was answered, but if it would be all right to maybe review it again. And it was the testimony from Dr. Hogan about, and it was the chart that showed the different mask types, so N95 and then down to the cloth masks. And I know you were saying collect and or the collection, and I just wanted, when I was listening to that, and then at the end, what was, I think, more clear to me is that even if it's the mask is collecting it, so we're not breathing it in, is, I guess, what I wanted to be clear that I understood, that it's not just collecting from the source, but that it's the mask is collecting the aerosols that could be carrying the virus so that we don't breathe them in. So if we could go back and look at that again and some clarification on that.
And Representative Pryor, was that question for Mr. Hogan?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Hogan, and I understand that, okay, I think my technical problems are solved now, so I do have the list, and also I heard that Mr. Huff has a couple extra slides. So, Mr. Hogan, can you address that question first? I don't know if the other slides pertain to that or not, but...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to address that, and thank you for the question. There is a different sizes are collected with different efficiencies, and 100% means everything is collected that either is coming in or coming out, and that's what we want. For sufficiently large particles and droplets, we do have 100% collection efficiency, really, with all masks, which is a nice thing. Oftentimes, when we talk about mask efficiency, we're often talking about them in terms of their worst-case scenario, not their best. And cloth masks, even these loosely fitting cloth masks, will collect particles and droplets that are larger than about 5 to 10 micrometers, whether we exhale them or whether we inhale them. They tend to be a little bit smaller when we're inhaling them because they've evaporated, and that's why they're better at, maybe we call it source control, but they certainly provide some protection to the wearer as well.
Okay. Representative Pryor?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, great. So I have Hewitt, Bierman, Bonner, and Keel. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Dr. Griffin, real quick, we've noticed with our young athletes or our youth athletes that what we've heard and what I've observed was that some of these children that get it were normally healthy, and then they come back, and now we're having trouble of getting them back to play. Have you had any experience with patients like this, and what do we expect with this to become?
Dr. Griffiths.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Representative Hutt, I want to make sure I understand your question correctly. Are you asking about children who have struggled to play sports, or post-COVID have they had trouble to return to play, meaning after they've had disease?
Return to play.
I see. Thank you. You know, I think I think return to play without the illness itself, you mean in terms of challenges of participating in teams and activities, is that correct?
Well, with the COVID itself, if you had a COVID patient that was an athlete, then we tried to get him returned to play.
So there are concerns in the American Academy of Pediatrics in terms of cardiac dysfunction after COVID. And as we're seeing from MISC, which is essentially an inflammatory process where the antibodies are fighting multiple organs in the body, one of the organs that gets attacked is the heart. And commonly in MISC, these children have had no underlying medical problems. In fact, that's really been our norm, is that the children in the hospital with MISC at Children's Minnesota had no underlying medical conditions. They had either their heart is essentially stretched to the point where it's not working, called cardiomyopathy, or the blood vessels that supply and feed the heart themselves have been dilated and are not functioning well. So yes, we are very careful in our approach with those children and the safety of returning to sports and activities. And they work closely with the cardiologists here in the state, as is recommended by the AAP.
Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Hewitt.
One real quick follow-up. Dr. Hogan, real quick, if you could answer, are there sports more susceptible to the aerosols than other sports? You see it in professional hockey right now, but what are you seeing in your studies, if any?
Mr. Hogan, I don't know if you're a doctor or mister. Are you a doctor?
It's PhD, but it's okay. Neither here nor there. And thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not able to speak to differences with respect to different sports, other than as a fan of the NFL, noticing when, you know, certain players were out with COVID. That said, what I can say is that there is a direct correlation between the volume that we speak at, sing at, or shout at, and the number of particles we produce. And we know that risk is elevated for infectious aerosol emission when people are speaking or talking at a high volume. And so activities that are associated with that could be classified as higher risk.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just wanted to thank all of the presenters. The Dr. Griffith's presentation on children was very enlightening, and Professor Hogan, those visuals on the exhaling was really interesting to watch and see, and how masks work like that. But my question I have is for Assistant Commissioner Huff, please. And I'm just wondering how we know that mask policies really work when compared to other states in particular, because people are often pointing to other states, our neighbors come to mind right away, and that we should adjust our policy to what our neighbors are doing. And I'm just wanting to know from you, what would the effect have been in Minnesota had we maintained a more maskless society through this pandemic, and how do you know?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, that's an excellent question. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll go through some more of my presentation, if that's okay, Madam Chair, because I think that will really help address Representative Bierman's question.
Yeah, you know what, Mr. Huff, let's hold on that for just a moment, because I want to see if members have more questions for Dr. Griffith, because she does have a hard stop. And so let's just hold on Representative Bierman's question, if we could, for a moment. And let's see, the next, we have Representative Bonner, Representative Keel. I think now I see Representative Grunhagen. And I just wonder if any of those questions are for Dr. Griffiths.
Madam Chair, I do have two questions, and one of them is for Dr. Griffiths.
All right. Representative Bonner, could you ask the one that's for her, and then hold on your other one, and we'll, so that we can have the benefit of her time here. Thank you. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Dr. Griffiths, I know you mentioned that you felt really comfortable with, you follow about 12,000 children, and specifically that you kind of follow their respiratory health in your area of expertise, and that many of them have, in fact, worn masks for some time and done so and fared quite well. I wonder, though, if you could address, you know, specifically when we talk about kiddos and participating in, you know, more physical activity and how, if you're comfortable with that and how you feel like you've seen that impact our kiddos.
Dr. Griffiths.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for that question. It really has been a learning curve, I think, for all of us. You know, sports masks, masks for resistance, masks for elite athletes are a separate issue that we've known about for some time. But in terms of children, we need to normalize that it feels different. And we have seen issues where children who may have a lung disease or may not have a lung disease may have discomfort with their exercise. They may hyperventilate. They may have anxiety, they may breath stack, or have other behavior-related symptoms related to the fact that they find it uncomfortable, and that can be distressing. And overthinking our breath can oftentimes make that worse, not in a particularly worrisome way, but distressing nonetheless. And if it's something that you're not used to seeing, it can be worrisome to coaches. It can be worrisome to parents. This has all been really new in terms of that on a larger scale with children with exercise. So we certainly have seen kids have discomfort with that as they're getting used to the new way that that feels with exercise. Add to that that in pandemic times, our children have been deconditioned. Our kids are out of shape, even not walking school hallways or going on errands with families is daily activity that they're not seeing. And so then if their only activity in their day is their sport, it's like they're running a marathon every day because that's the most they've worked out all day. So we're seeing issues related to that as well.
Representative Bonner.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I guess my other part of that question is too, but I'm curious, have you seen the children expressing issues in, you know, you said there's some issues with tolerating because of discomfort, but in terms of, you know, overall health and their ability to have a mask and wear it, I'm just curious if you could speak to, is wearing the mask impacting their health in general, aside from those folks who may, you know, be uncomfortable?
Dr. Griffiths?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's a great follow-up question. In terms of whether or not masks are affecting their health in general with activities and sports, I think we have to think about how we define health. In terms of lung disease, really, we haven't had patients who have had worsening lung disease related to wearing their masks. We have seen difficulties with breathing, with vocal cord mobility, where they've changed the way that they're breathing. We've seen that hyperventilation, that breath stacking. We are not seeing this trigger severe lung disease, no. Of course, this is separate from children who are neuromuscularly weak or medically fragile, cerebral palsy, other cognitive delays, as well as physical delays. That's a separate category. But we're not seeing these masks cause significant lung disease in our children. We haven't seen it. I can count on one hand the number of letters people ask us all the time, is your group writing mask exemption letters? And we take that question really seriously. I've written one, and the mask exemption letter I wrote was for a child with severe sensory integration and autism. And because the child had asthma, the primary care doctor really wanted me to write the letter, although I felt it had nothing to do with the child's asthma, but they wanted to make sure that the asthma doctor was okay with this. And as it turns out, while it was very anxiety provoking for her and very difficult for her to get used to that sensory difference, when she went to school with a shield, she decided she hated the shield and she asked her mother for the mask. And then the one letter that I've written, now that child wears a mask. Certainly there are other children who cannot wear masks because of their physical impairments, but that's my N of one. In our practice, we can really count on one hand where we've not been able to successfully have children wear masks who would otherwise be able to.
Thank you. So Representative Keel, is your question to Dr. Griffiths? Because we just have 5 more minutes with her.
Yes,
please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Griffiths, I am hearing from athletes, parents of athletes, that when they are playing, their masks become soaked really quickly because of the moisture in the area they're in or just sweat and, you know. So I'm wondering, when you're playing hard and breathing in as well as exhaling, is that moisture not damaging to the lungs? And are we seeing, I'm guessing children get through diseases easier, but are we seeing an increase in pneumonia and other types of breathing issues, especially with probably more teenagers are, you know, working harder at athletes at that point, at running and exercise?
Dr. Griffiths?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel. That's also a really important question. Yes, we are seeing certainly increased moisture and sweat and wet masks with exertion. Absolutely. It is a bear. It is a pretty big nuisance in terms of disruption and needing multiple masks to switch out. We do recommend switching out masks when they are notably soiled or notably wet. It is more difficult to breathe through a very wet mask. We think it's less effective as well. No, we are not finding that the moisture is more damaging to lungs at this point. In fact, children with asthma in general breathe better in moisture and humidity. So we tend to find that things like cold air, and which can often be a trigger for asthma attacks, we're seeing less of those with mask wearing. We think that's related to moisture and humidity. The cilia or the little hairs lining the airway, they like moisture. When it is the depths of winter in Minnesota and we've got our heat cranked up and it's cold outside and our houses are dry and we all kind of cough and hack in our polar vortex, part of that is a dry airway. We're seeing less of that with mask wearing. We're actually not seeing an increase in pneumonia. Overall, we're not seeing an increase in hospitalizations. If anything, we've had a decline. And there's certainly been a lot of interest in terms of volume of cases within pediatrics. And with mask wearing, I would say my partners and I all have felt that our asthmatics have been the best controlled they've ever been. We're seeing fewer infections overall and fewer pneumonias.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just occurred to me when Dr. Griffiths was saying this. Do you know the difference between, and this is a bigger question, so maybe something we can think about in later conversations, but we have students that are attending school on a regular basis. We have students that are not, they're doing distance learning or in between. Have we noticed a difference at all in how exposed they are, asthma, those types of things? You know, there's a lot of difference between who's doing what. I know a lot of private schools, well, I think most of them are actively in school and playing sports. And then we have public schools all over the board as to, you know, where they're going, if they're going to school or not. So wondering if you're seeing any difference there.
Okay, and I know that Dr. Griffiths has to get going, but can you take a stab at that, Dr. Griffiths?
I'll do my best. Thanks, Madam Chair and Representative Keel. I think I'm understanding the question correctly, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, Representative. Your question is, am I seeing a difference in terms of exposure and risk as it relates to school or sports and illness? Is that right? Yes, I'm seeing you nod.
Yeah.
So I would say across the board, we are seeing fewer infections, fewer flares of their underlying lung disease. Our patient population really does run the gamut at Children's Respiratory, kind of a 50-50 split from a payer mix, you could say. We take care of many children, both in private school and in public school. It's a pretty diverse patient population and fairly heterogeneous. So my sense is that it's been down in both. And I think that our hospitalizations as well as our asthma program, which tracks hospitalizations, steroid courses, and that sort of thing, have all shown really a decline this year in terms of frequency of needing that escalated support. Overall, I've been really encouraged by that. Certainly, there's been a mix of who's decided to go remote versus in person, who's doing sports and who's not. I think there is a big mix there. You're correct. But I'm really not seeing that translating into changes in terms of frequency of pneumonia or flares in their illnesses.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Griffiths. We'll let you go. We really so appreciate your being here with us today. And I know we've all found it very, very interesting. So thank you. So members, we will go back now. So I'm going to go back, and I apologize to Representative Grunhagen if he had a question for Dr. Griffiths that we did not get to. But we're going to go back to Bierman. So we'll go Bierman. Since Grunhagen's been waiting, maybe we could do Bierman and then Grunhagen, Bonner, Keel, if there are other questions that those members have. So Representative Bierman and Mr.
Madam Chair, I thought Commissioner Huff was going to finish some slides first.
There we go. Okay, I think this is the answer to your question, I believe, or part of it. Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I'll go through this, and then hopefully by the end I will have answered your specific question, Representative Bierman. Please follow up. So I wanted to talk specifically about what's currently in effect around masking, which is the governor's executive order. And just whenever we talk about the governor's executive orders, I think it's important to just put it into this Venn diagram, which is in every decision that the governor has made, it has been a balance between how do we control the spread of COVID, how do we maintain well-being of Minnesota's lives, and how do we maintain a healthy economy. Next slide, please. When we look at everything that we have done and the governor has done in his executive orders, these are some of our guiding principles, and it's protecting both the public health but also worker health. So often I think there's been a lot of questions about schools. So we think about students, but we also think about their teachers and custodians and bus drivers. Protect hospital capacity. We were in an alarming state back around Thanksgiving, and that's not where we want to be. And we want all of our businesses to be as open as they safely can be. And we want to build consumer confidence, and we want to have maintain sustainability. And then equity is a thread that is throughout everything that we do, as we know that there are disparate impacts of COVID as there are for many diseases. Next slide, please. So the executive order on masking became in effect of the end of last July, and it requires people to wear masks in all indoor public spaces unless you're alone. And that workers need to wear them even in outdoor situations where social distancing cannot be maintained. Next slide, please. There are some exemptions. Children 5 years and younger are not required to wear a mask. And in fact, children under 2 probably should not wear a mask because they do not have they're just not old enough to be able to control that mask, and it could be a choking hazard. And then if you have a mental or a medical disability that would prevent you from being able to tolerate a mask, then an alternative should be used, such as a face shield. Next slide. Consideration for face shields. Now, face shields do not substitute for the effectiveness of a mask, but they can be used if masks cannot be tolerated. That is a full face mask. You may have seen some of these sort of half masks. Those are not allowed under the executive order. Next slide. State by state, we have masks in many states. So you will see a representative. We do have three surrounding states, neighboring states, that do not have masking, and I'll show some of the comparisons there. Next slide. Since we passed the governor enacted the emergency executive order for face coverings, we have significantly increased the use of masking in Minnesota. Next slide. So this kind of gets to your specific question. To ground us in this slide, this shows the case rate per 100,000 people from the beginning of the pandemic, when we had our first case back in April of last year, up until I think this goes through about a week ago. And you will see that our case rate went up in May last year. That's when we had our first kind of peak, and then went down and was very stable through most of the summer, and then started to increase in the fall, and then hit an exponential growth phase where we hit that really alarming period in Thanksgiving. We had our dial back, and subsequently we've gone quite down, steadily down. Next slide. Hospital admissions follow closely case rate. You have just a percentage of the cases that end up in the hospital, and they usually lag there. Next slide. You can see that same trend is for ICU admissions. So the more cases we have, the more hospitals we have, and the more ICU admissions, and that there's a bit of a lag there. And then finally, the next slide, you have deaths. So deaths, again, the more cases we have, the more deaths we have. It's a pretty straight percentage of our case growth. Next slide. If we look at our growth this last fall, when we hit our peak, surrounding states in the upper Midwest also hit a peak. But you will see is that our peak was smaller and shorter in duration, especially compared to the Dakotas. And if we look at our death rate then, next slide, we see, so the star here is when a state hit one death per 1,000 people. So think of a game at the U.S. Bank Stadium, a football game, and of all the people watching that game, 64 of them die. That's one of out of 1,000 people. So North Dakota hit that first, then South Dakota, then Iowa, and then quite a bit later, we in Minnesota hit it, and then Wisconsin hit it after us. It's interesting that if we looked at the case rate of death in just the period of the fall surge, Wisconsin actually outpaced us in death. If we compare ourselves to the Dakotas, if we had the exact same death rate that they had, over 4,000 more Minnesotans would have died last year. Now, is it just the masking? I would say it's a combination of the factors that we in Minnesota have done differently than the Dakotas, but they have been significant. So that's over 4,000 Minnesotans that were able to celebrate the new year, where if we'd had the same death rate of the Dakotas, they would have been dead. Next slide. Just to go again about how tricky things can move, and I think this is, you know, there's been a lot of questions about, you know, why do we enact, you know, the governor, why did he do a dial back here or dial back there. And I think it's because the nature of infectious disease is when it hits an exponential growth. We can see that with mitigation measures, masking and other mitigation measures, we were able to keep case growth really stable. But once it started to increase, we hit a period of exponential growth, and it's always challenging to know when we hit that. So last fall in September is when we first reached 15 cases per 100,000. Today, by the way, we are about 16.6 cases per 100,000. So we're still above that 15, although we're dropping, which is good. So at that point, we started to grow. Our cases started to increase. And within 3 weeks, we'd gone from 15 to 20 cases per 100,000. 2 weeks later, we went from 20 to 30. And then within 2 to 3 weeks after hitting 30 cases per 100,000, we hit 120 cases per 100,000. And what we find is anything above 10 cases per 100,000 is in a danger range of starting to accelerate and then hitting that exponential growth. And while we are seeing good progress in our numbers, we are still at an elevated level. And this is this exponential growth chart is why we are still in public health hesitant to go celebrate our great numbers, because we're not where we need to be to really prevent us from going back into this quick exponential spread. Next slide. To give you an idea of what happens with our case rate, I said we're at 16.6 cases per 100,000, which is much better. Even then, though, at 15, we would have 80 deaths per week. Even if we drop down to 10, that is 60 Minnesotans that will die per week of COVID, even if we are down to 10 cases per 100,000. And I say this because just reaching 10 cases does not mean that we're out of the pandemic. We still, masking is still so important to continue to drive these cases down, because COVID does result in death. It does result in hospitalization. And as Dr. Griffiths talked about, it does result even in children with some severe cardiovascular diseases. Next slide. That's my presentation. So, Representative, hopefully that answered your question. I can't say for sure what masking did versus not, but we know that if we compare ourselves to the Dakotas, we had a significantly savings of life because of the measures that were done here in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Hoff. We really appreciate that. And Representative Bierman, did that address your question, or did you have a follow-up to that?
Madam Chair, yes, that definitely addressed my question very thoroughly. Thank you, Commissioner Hoff, for that. I do have a follow-up, and I just wonder if you could comment briefly on the difference of exposure between a visit to a retail shop to pick up a can of paint versus exposure at, let's say, a wedding.
Mr. Hoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. So when we look at exposure, we look at time. We look at, is someone masked? Are they conversing with each other? And then how close they are together. If I go to the store, I pick up a can of paint, and I maybe talk to the worker there to mix up my paint, and then I talk to the person to check out. That talking, I'm expelling more breath, but if I'm masked and if that person is distanced and we're not together for a very long period of time, then it is very unlikely that I will spread that disease to that other person. If I'm at a wedding, I'm there for a longer period of time. If I'm eating or drinking, I have to take my mask off, which, as you saw from Professor Hogan's great illustration there of that stream, how it shoots out of us, even though it's invisible, it's coming. But then also at a wedding, we're much more social. You know, it's a social event. We're there with friends, with family. We often get closer to each other. We talk with each other for longer periods of time. We may dance, which is in closer proximity. So that we would consider a much higher risk setting, just because we're likely to be in contact for a longer period of time, closer to each other, and then socializing or conversing with each other, and perhaps even unmasked.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Huff, and not to mention likely or possibly drinking alcohol, which makes people less careful about a lot of things. So, all right, thank you. Let's move on here, and I know that Representative Grunhagen's been waiting. We do want to get to the bill hearing sometime here, but these are really important questions that really do relate to both. So I'm going to go to Representative Grunhagen, and then we'll check back quickly with Bonner and Keel, and then we'll go ahead with other members who've raised their hands. So, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the testifiers. I got a couple questions. First one is kind of along the lines of Representative Bierman. You know, in Christmas, when we went shopping at large department stores, and yet a lot of other smaller businesses were closed, one particular store we were in was just packed with people at Christmas time and close proximity, and yet it seemed like we didn't have a problem with that, okay? And yet a small business right down the road had to be closed, like the flower shop, and I was happened to have one in my community, and I was in there the other day, and she started crying when I asked her how business was going. And yet she was practicing a lot of the safe things, and she didn't see why she was closed when these big businesses, especially over Christmas, were open with people walking right next to each other all over the department stores. Any thoughts on that?
I think for Mr. Huff. And possibly we could maybe get Professor Hogan to talk about that too, but go ahead, Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, the governor's executive orders did not close flower shops during this dial-back period. The particular settings that were closed were not retail settings. Now, the instance that you gave, yes, there is risk. When we're in a global pandemic, any time that we are interacting outside of our household, any time that we are not maintaining social distancing, any time that we're doing that for a period of time, that increases the risk. So it is not that those are safe, but they are lower risk than the settings that were part of the dial back, which included gyms, included restaurants and bars, because those are settings that are higher risk. People are there for a longer duration. For gyms, they are exhaling at a very high rate because they're exercising. For bars and restaurants, they are taking off their mask because they're eating. Both of those settings are often kind of social. You kind of see the same group of people when you're going to work out at a gym, or you see the same group of people, or maybe you're visiting with friends at a bar restaurant. So that social setting means that you're conversing more and laughing and talking, which propels droplets farther. So from a setting perspective, not every setting was closed. Retail was left open, so the flower shop was open, or at least it was not closed by a governor's order. The business owner may have closed. But, you know, I think you point out appropriately that all settings have risk. It's one of the reasons that masking is so important, because it really does it's an incredibly sort of low-intensive, low-economic impact, low social impact way of really curbing disease and making all of our situations safer, all these, whether it be retail or others. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Hopf. And I don't know if Professor Hogan wanted to weigh in on any of the questions about the different settings, or you don't have to, but I just didn't want to skip if you had something you wanted to add.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to. So, we have, of course, masking, which helps reduce risk but does not completely eliminate it, and social distancing as well. One other factor in these various scenarios is what we call the air change rate in the rooms that we're in, which is the number of times per hour that the air is reset, if you will. These are very, very different depending on the age of the building and the codes that were established when the HVAC system was developed for that building, as well as the building size. Any building that is going to have people come in does need to very carefully consider how many people they can handle, as well as the time between people in terms of mitigating risk. And that's something that individuals can also ask about the spaces they enter. What is the air change rate in that space?
All right. Thank you. So I'm going to go back Bonner had a follow-up question, Representative Pryor, and then Representative Ackland, and then I think we should move to our bill. Yeah. We have a number of testifiers waiting. So did you have a follow-up, Representative Grunhagen?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the second thing I have to say is I did a little bit of research on the mask myself, and I'm sure you're familiar with the Great Barrington Declaration. And it's signed by, I believe, epidemiologist and public health scientists here in the United States. The last figure I saw was about 43,000 of them. And they say we should take a focused protection on those who are more at risk. And the rest of society should be able to go back, especially 70 and under, back to normal living. And that, in fact, by doing some of the things we're doing, it actually is causing more problems for children and health problems and everything else. And you can look it up on the internet, the Great Barrington Declaration. And that a lot of this stuff actually has more negative than positive effects. In addition to that, the American Institute of Physics issued a statement on wearing masks, and they tested several masks, and they said masks are not enough to stop COVID-19 spread, okay? And they basically said that the COVID droplets get through, unless it's like an N95, of course. And again, we got to save that for the medical people.
Well, you know, Representative Grunhagen, there are members who are waiting here to ask questions. And I would just say that Professor Hogan just testified all about that. I mean, could you just ask a question? And
yeah,
then let's get other members to let
based
get
on it here. Based on these two organizations, do you think we should look at a focused approach to COVID-19 rather than a one-size-fits-all blanket mandate?
So, Mr. Huff, why don't you start on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think if we think of the slides I just showed, where our hospitalizations, our ICU, and our deaths follow the exact same curves as our cases. When you have a highly infectious respiratory disease, no one can live in a bubble. Even our long-term care residents, unless you were to cloister away the workers so that they never went home to their families or never went to the store or saw friends, there is no way to prevent disease from moving in and out of different social groups. Per the particular study that you mentioned or the thing that you mentioned signed, Madam Chair, if you like, I know we do have our deputy state epidemiologist on who has reviewed that, and he can speak to that specifically if you would like.
I think that since that's kind of the question of the moment, who is that?
Would be Dr. Richard Danila.
Oh, okay. Dr. Danila?
Okay, Madam Chair and Representatives.
Yeah, welcome.
Question about the Great Barrington Declaration.
And could you just please state your name for the record and give us who you are?
Richard Danila, D-A-N-I-L-A. So the Great Barrington Declaration was sort of a worldwide petition by some scientists, mostly to basically end lockdowns and open up. And it's been largely really kind of discredited and forgotten at this point. No reputable scientists really signed on. And the World Health Organization actually commented on the Great Barrington Declaration and said it lacks credibility and is a dangerous position.
So I wonder if Professor Hogan. Sorry, Dr. Danila, were you finished?
Yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. And I wonder if, Professor Hogan, since part of that kind of went back through some of what you had talked about, I wonder if you could comment on that again, if you wouldn't mind, the allegation that the masks don't really matter and the rest of that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would be happy to. So I really do appreciate going into the scientific literature to look at different studies. The one thing I would like to caution is that the American Institute of Physics publishes a journal called Physics of Fluid, which has totally circumvented the peer review process in recent months in the name of putting out articles that generate publicity, many of them inappropriately done. For example, they will claim that masks are ineffective using really faulty experiments in that particular journal. The reality is that masks are effective at collecting particles which are a micrometer and larger. They will have a minimum, typically around 100 nanometers to 300 nanometers. Those particles are too small to contain any sort of viable virus. And so it's really a straw man argument that we're looking at here. I can, of course, find a particle size that gets through. That particle size is simply too small to have anything infectious within it.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor. All right. Let's go back to Representative Bonner, then Pryor, then Ackland. Representative Bonner, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a question and maybe a brief follow-up to that. My question was actually for Professor Hogan. I know there's been a number of experiments, and maybe you could speak to this. I know you did some calculations at, 1 foot, 3 foot, et cetera, or 6 feet. But I also, to that larger point, I just wonder if you could speak to without masks. And we talk a lot about 6 foot as this magical number, right? But if we don't have a mask, could you speak a little bit to the length or distance that some of that spray or vapor can travel? Because I suspect it is much more than 6 feet.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Representative Bonner, was that for Professor Hogan?
Yes.
Yeah, Professor Hogan?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. The 6 foot rule is actually a very good rule for those larger droplets. That's the distance about that they can travel before they'll settle out to the ground. But it was never a rule that was designed for these smaller aerosols. The smaller aerosols will stay in the air and travel around with the fluid flow really indefinitely until they are cleared by ventilation. And so with aerosols in an indoor space, it doesn't become a question of distance, but a question of time and ventilation rate. We have studies ongoing right now that suggest that provided you're in the same office space as a person, the distance doesn't matter. The time spent in the office really does matter. I do want to emphasize that masks, of course, just simply reduce the amount of particles being emitted by a person and reduce the amount that you inhale. And so it will reduce those risks in really every environment that we can think of.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay.
May I follow briefly?
Well, real briefly, because we have two other members. Yeah, go ahead.
I will. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that, Professor Hogan. And it kind of underscores the point of catching those droplets when they're a little bit larger and easier to catch closer up. And also, I just wanted to speak to the overall message here. We talked a lot about masks, and I think we talk about them as if they live in a vacuum, that they're somehow a magic bullet. And Dr. Osterholm made the comment the other day that just like if you're in a car accident, what will save you? Is it only an airbag? Probably not. Is it only a seatbelt? Probably not. And so I think the really important takeaway that I've gotten from today and is that really we're talking about a compilation of factors. We're talking about masks. We're talking about distance. We're talking about limiting the duration that we're in the presence. We're talking about airflow. We're talking about washing your hands and using common sense measures. And that all of those combined are really the key to keeping down spread. And I really appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Chair, actually, for and all the staff that pulled together the presenters today. And I, just to thank Dr. Hogan and Dr. Griffiths and our representatives from the Department of Health for being here. I understand things so much better. And I've been reading about, all of these articles and all of the science and trying to understand and process it since the very beginning of all of this. And today I just had so much more clarity. So thank you for the clarity that you brought to this discussion, and just really appreciate being able to sit here and ask questions too on top of everything else. So I think probably this one will be from Mr. Huff. And, you know, we've heard from Dr. Osterholm about the new variants and that heightened concern about what might lie ahead. So, and I know that this is something, obviously, that you're watching and talking about, so that we're looking at the experiences in Brazil, in the United Kingdom, and Portugal. And is there any evidence now about, is anything coming forward for masks, or is there other, I know that the United Kingdom had to do another shutdown because of the high levels of hospitalization and deaths. Is there anything that we should be thinking about and knowing about, especially, you know, as we talk about this preventive measure of mask wearing?
Mr. Huff?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, we are definitely concerned about the new variants that you've discussed. Our public health lab does whole genome sequencing. We do surveillance for this. We have detected, I believe now we're at about 18 cases of the B117 variant. That's the variant that was first identified in the UK. We have at least 2 cases of the P1 variant. That's the variant that was first identified in Brazil. We also have a couple cases now of the variant coming from the West Coast. In looking at the epidemiologic studies and just how swiftly the B117 variant moved through the UK, it does appear that it may be anywhere between 30 to 50% more infectious. So that's definitely of concern. I think it just underscores the importance of mask wearing. We have, and are providing just some updated guidance. You know, some people have asked, you know, well, should we do double masks? Definitely that, you know, the more fabric layers you have, the more effective the mask. Some people have talked about that Swiss cheese effect. You know, you have a slice of Swiss cheese with holes here, and you put another slice here, and if the holes don't line up, you can actually form a more, you know, permanent barrier there. So I think it just underscores why masking is so important, but why these other mitigation measures we've talked about are also so important. We want to continue the amazing progress that Minnesotans have fought so hard for. You know, the dial back over the holidays was very difficult for all of us. We do not want to lose that progress. So I think just speaks to the importance of these mitigation measures. Any additional questions on the variants? I know that either our state epidemiologist or deputy epidemiologist can speak to those directly. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Huff. And I think we, rather than do that, because it takes us just a bit off topic, but any follow-up, Representative Pryor? Okay, thank you. Representative Ackland, thanks for your patience. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to the presenters. Very good, very useful. Mr. Huff said something about the USS Theodore problem that they had, and the difference between those who wore the mask, excuse me, and those who didn't. It sparked a question in my mind that nobody has talked about here, and I think maybe Professor Hagen can answer it. But when he does his studies on the expulsion, he talks about wearing the mask, but he never talks about how the effect that these droplets have that get into your eyes. So as I worked in the emergency room, so many times we wore goggles because we knew that splash in our eyes could be significant. And so I've seen there's a continuum of people who are super afraid of the virus and those who are minimally afraid of the virus. And for those who are super afraid, I'm just wondering if goggles are an option for them if they really want to truly protect themselves, or what is the chance if these droplets get in your mouth versus your eyes or eyes versus your mouth? Are you just as likely to catch it if drops in your eyes as if in your mouth, or if you inhale it through your nose? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Hogan, I know some of that's probably not within your bailiwick about how infectious it is, but if you could take the first part of the question, and then maybe Mr. Huff can take the second part.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. It is true, yeah, the mechanism of infection and the required dose for visible symptoms is well outside my field of expertise. That said, in aerosol exposure, we don't just look at inhalation exposure, but deposition on our entire body, including our eyes. Dr. Fauci has been on record talking about eye protection from aerosols as well. They certainly will deposit on our entire body. And that is a good point that we should think about the fact that when we've been out and we've been exposed, it's not just potentially through inhalation, but through deposition on everything. And we should think about really, you know, washing our clothes, washing our hands, washing our hair is actually a great surface for deposition as well when we return home.
Thank you. And Mr. Huff, did you want to comment as well on the?
Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Acklin. You know, there are studies that show that masking in addition to a face shield improved the efficacy. I think you're right that there is concern of the splash that we talk about, and a face shield is protective of your eyes. It's one of the reasons in our safe learning plan, we strongly encourage educators to wear both a face shield and a mask. My wife, who works in elementary school, wore her face shield and mask at lunch yesterday, just because lunch can be a little messier, especially when you're dealing with kindergartners. So yes, you're right. It definitely adds to that protection. It's another barrier to protect the eyes and the mucous membranes there.
Yeah, Representative Acklin.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we are going to then move to the bill. Thank you so much to the presenters. And if you can stick around in case there are questions as we go through the bill hearing, that would be really great. But we're going to hear House File 604. Representative Jordan is here. So, members, what we're going to do, we have a number of testifiers, both for and against the bill. And Representative Jordan is just going to make her little presentation, and then we're going to ask House Research to walk through the bill. And there's an author's amendment, too, which we'll walk through just so everybody knows what's in the bill. And then the idea is to go to the testifiers. So what I'd like to do, if it's okay with everyone, is we've designated that we would give a half hour to each side. So we're going to take the testifiers who are opposed to the bill. I'd like to let them all testify and then have questions of them if there are some questions, and then do the other side and then take questions of them just to make sure that we can do this expeditiously. And please be patient with us. We haven't done this quite this way before in the virtual world. So Representative Jordan, so the chair will move that House File 604 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a privilege to be here having this vital discussion about public health and our role as policymakers with all of you this afternoon. And I am incredibly grateful to Chair Lee Wing for holding this hearing about how we can best protect Minnesotans from COVID-19. I'm bringing House File 604 today because masks save lives. As we've heard today from the Minnesota Health Department, Dr. Griffiths, and Professor Hogan, masks work. They prevent the spread of the virus by reducing aerosols that a COVID-positive individual breathes out and reduces the aerosols that others breathe in. In Minnesota, we've been fortunate to live in a state that has had a mask policy in place since July. The Center for Disease Control did an early release of a report on February 5th that compared states, including Minnesota, with mask mandates in place to states that didn't, and found that these policies have resulted in lower positivity rates, lower hospitalization rates, and lower healthcare costs. Dr. Osterholm spoke before this very committee just last week and talked about how wearing masks and physically distancing are critical pillars to hold up our health infrastructure while we vaccinate and respond to new virus variants. Members, the word novel means something new and unknown, and fighting a deadly unknown pathogen is hard. Legislating is always hard, but it is especially hard while we combat the health and economic impacts of this deadly global pandemic. For months, I've heard members plead to be a part of the state's pandemic response. We've heard ideas about public health, concerns for worker safety, strategies for small businesses, economic stimulus proposals, and bills to prioritize learning in schools. House File 604 is a bill to serve as part of the foundation for that work that I've heard so many of you demand to be a part of. If members want more students to return to in-person learning, they should support this bill. If members want to do more than simply call workers heroes and push for workplace protections, they should support this bill. If members want to prevent more small businesses from closing, they should support this bill. And if members want to save lives, they should support this bill. And if members want to be part of the response to COVID-19, they should support this bill. Members, I want the legislature to be part of the response to COVID-19. I want to work with all of you to deliberate, debate, and craft public policy that makes lives better for all Minnesotans. We all ran for office to do this work, and we will hear a testimony from healthcare professionals and talk about ideas to make this bill better. My understanding is that the bill will be laid over to give us a chance to continue to work on this bill beyond today. I sincerely hope to work with each of you on how to improve this bill. That is our job as legislators. We need to listen to experts, work together, and make hard decisions. With that, I stand ready to listen to testimony and work on this bill with all of you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. And Ms. Clarkvist from House of Research, if you would just quickly kind of walk us through what's in the bill, we would appreciate it. Welcome.
Sure, Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research, and I was going to talk about the bill and amendment together, if that will work for the committee.
That's up to Ms. Jordan, Representative Jordan. Is that okay with you?
That's fine with me. Madam Chair, do we want to move the amendment now or after Ms. Clarkvist's overview?
Well, if you're going to describe them together, then I think we should probably move the amendment. So there is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. And that is the A5 amendment, I understand. So on behalf of the author, the chair will move the A5. And so we'll just, if members would unmute, we'll just see if we have the votes to adopt the A5. And then we can just, Ms. Clarkvist can describe it all together. So all in favor of the A5. Please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
Okay. No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And thank you. And so, Ms. Clarkvist, go ahead and describe the bill as amended.
Okay, Madam Chair and members. Again, I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research. Beginning with Section 1 of this bill, Section 1 establishes face covering requirements. Subdivision 1 defines terms for the bill, and some of the terms defined are amended in the amendment. The definition of business is amended to remove the judicial branch from that definition. The definition of childcare setting is deleted, and definitions are added for commissioner, industry guidance, intercollegiate sports, physical distancing, and professional sports. And then the definition of social distancing is removed from the draft, from the bill, because physical distancing is used instead of social distancing. Subdivision 2 of the bill establishes face covering requirements, lists individuals and circumstances in which face coverings are required. The amendment changes the age at and above which an individual must wear a face covering from age 5 to age 6. Subdivision 3 lists settings and circumstances where an individual is not required to wear a face covering. The amendment changes the age at and below which you're not required to wear a face covering from age 4 to age 5. The amendment also deletes clause 6, which said that childcare workers were not required to wear a face covering when they were actively caring for children. Subdivision 4 lists circumstances when you may temporarily remove a face covering. And the amendment clarifies Clause 1 to say that you may temporarily remove a face covering when you're engaged in public speaking, not just speaking. Clause 2 is also clarified by using the term intercollegiate sport, which is a defined term, and requiring sports to meet the minimum testing and mitigation requirements. Subdivision 5 allows businesses and local units of government to adopt more protective ordinances or policies. Subdivision 6 provides that wearing a face covering does not violate Section 609.735, which makes it a misdemeanor to cover your face in public. The amendment adds another paragraph to this subdivision saying that any provision of this section that where there is also federal guidance on this topic, it would be preempted by that federal guidance, that if that federal guidance is more protective. In the amendment, a new subdivision 7 allows the commissioner to establish additional exemptions and clarify the requirements of this section via interpretive guidance, and says that this guidance is not subject to rulemaking. A new subdivision 8 exempts federal officials, the state judicial branch, and tribal nations from this section. And that's section 1. Section 2 of the bill specifies duties of businesses. Subdivision 1 establishes business duties related to face covering requirements in COVID-19 preparedness plans. And the amendment clarifies that this subdivision only applies to businesses that are required to have a COVID-19 preparedness plan. Subdivision 2 requires businesses to provide notice of face covering requirements. Subdivision 3 includes implementation requirements. And these clauses are clarified in the amendment. Clauses 1 and 2 were amended to clarify that the implementation requirements are also governed by the business's COVID-19 preparedness plan. In Clause 3, the duties of businesses are clarified regarding providing reasonable accommodations for people who are not able to wear masks. Paragraph B is also modified in the amendment. It clarifies that a business can't require a customer to explain why they're not wearing a face covering, but for all other persons, including workers, the business has to follow other laws regarding requiring the individual to provide documentation of why they're not wearing a face covering. Section 3 is the enforcement section. Subdivision 1 establishes penalties for noncompliance by an individual. Subdivision 2 establishes criminal penalties for noncompliance by an owner, manager, or supervisor of a business. Subdivision 3 establishes civil penalties for noncompliance by a business. And paragraph B is amended in the amendment, or it's included in the amendment. And this authorizes the attorney general and city attorneys and county attorneys to seek civil relief according to section 8.31. Subdivision 4 allows state and local licensing and regulatory authorities to use their existing tools to assess and ensure compliance with sections 1 and 2. And then section 4 provides for expiration of the face covering requirements. And this is also amended in the amendment. So as amended, sections 1 to 3 would expire upon the earlier of issuance by the CDC of guidance on measures to prevent COVID-19 transmission that do not include a recommendation to wear a face covering or a determination by the Commissioner of Health that an enforceable face covering requirement is no longer necessary. And that's the bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Clarkfist. So, okay. So with that, members, we will go to testifiers. And so we're taking first the testifiers in opposition. So first we have Diane Smith. And Ms. Smith, welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name for the record and just tell us if you're here representing anyone, and then I'll go ahead and you have two minutes for our testifiers.
Can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair. Do we have 2 minutes? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Okay, so just let me know when I'm ready. And
yeah, please go ahead. Just introduce yourself. Just tell us who you are and whether you're representing anyone besides yourself. And then just please go ahead and tell us what you want us to know.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Diane Smith. I am speaking in opposition to HF 604. The most important aspect of what our government upholds is the very oath you all swore to God to protect our individual rights and freedoms, and that all political power is inherent in the people. And you, representing the people, derive your just powers from the consent of the people. You have sworn an oath to God to establish, to protect, and maintain people's individual rights, not to dismiss the Constitution because of fear of a contagion. Breathing freely without restriction, it's a basic human right, period. Back in 1918, if we're going to learn from our past to deal with the present, they did a mask versus no mask study. One was over in Stockton, California, where masks were worn. Boston, Massachusetts, masks were not worn. And the study is right here. You can see the lines, and it shows very same. There was no difference. Okay. According to Dr. Fauci, we all know the study that he did back in 2008. Most people are very familiar with it. The predominant role of bacterial pneumonia, or was bacterial pneumonia rather, and it was the cause of death in pandemics. And people have done the research. I'm actually doing a Petri research, a test with the kids that I'm teaching. This is 20 minutes of wearing a mask. That's what's in your mask that you are telling kids to be breathing in. And you know kids are not changing their masks every 20 minutes. Representative Liveling, you said it best, and I'm quoting you. It says, we must protect the freedom of every Minnesotan to speak their mind, maintain their privacy, and make their own important decisions. And I couldn't agree with you more. Supporting this bill is a direct contradiction to this quote. I'm asking everyone to please oppose 604. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Ms. Smith, and exercising your First Amendment rights. We appreciate it. Okay, next. And please hang around if you could in case there are questions from members.
Okay, very good.
Wayne Rohde.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and the presenters. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you today about opposition to House File 604. My name is Wayne Rohde, author of The Vaccine Court and father to a vaccine-injured son. I live in Maplewood, Minnesota, in Leon Lilly's district. I rise in opposition to this bill for several reasons, but due to time constraints, I will focus on just a couple. As the bill states in House File 604, we are allowing the CDC to dictate when to wear a mask. This is not good policy nor good science. This should be left up to Minnesota. Now, under the Biden administration, a new decree by the CDC has been announced on the back of that executive order. The CDC is using TSA agents and other federal authorities, as well as state and local officials, will now start enforcing mask wearing. This has turned into a quasi-homeland security force. This is no doubt will turn into a new effort to monitor and surveil citizens. This bill will allow turning over the governing of our state, which is in your hands, the people of Minnesota, to a non-elected federal agency, essentially a quasi-homeland security force. I ask you to consider what this bill is really about. Turning over decision-making from our state and local elected officials to a one-size-fits-all federal agency without any recourse and very little congressional oversight. You are our elected officials, representatives to the Minnesota legislature. We elect you and hold you accountable for these decisions. Thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Rohde. Appreciate you being here. And please hang around, just as I said to Ms. Smith, in case there are questions for you. We appreciate it. So let's see. Next, we have Twyla Braes. Ms. Braes, haven't seen you in a long time, but welcome.
I know. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm glad to be here. My name is Twyla Braes. I'm a registered nurse and the president and co-founder of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We oppose House File 604. Dr. Michael Osterholm, former interim director of the CDC, in a June interview said this: "Never before in my 45-year career have I seen such a far-reaching public recommendation issued by any governmental agency without a single source of data or information to support it." He also added, "The highest frequency of mask-wearing population in the world is in Hubei, China. It didn't make a difference," end quote. Daniel Huff just said that he's not sure what masking did. And in that vein, it's notable that after Minnesota's mask mandate was imposed on July 25, cases and deaths rose for the next 5 months. They only began to drop around the holidays. And so I did, if you can see this, maybe, or maybe not. But anyway, so the virus has gone up and down in the 7 months of the masking mandate. Now, I just want to say a little bit about infectiousness. A recent study found that an infected person without symptoms has only a 3.5% chance of spreading it to a close contact. And there is only a 21.1% chance of getting COVID-19 from a household member with symptoms. Thus, it is unlikely that people will get it just walking around. A close contact was described as like at a party or around having dinner or that sort of thing. Now I'll move to cases and deaths because these data are being used to keep the mandate in place. The validity of the PCR COVID test is being challenged worldwide. In August, the New York Times found that up to 90% of the PCR positive cases in three states were false positives. A court in Portugal has now dismissed the PCR test as invalid. And 22 scientists have asked a journal to retract the study that claims that the PCR test could diagnose COVID-19. In fact, one study found that the specimens of most positive tests using high cycle thresholds cannot culture the virus. In addition, many reported deaths may be people who died with COVID and not from COVID, so we're not sure about how to interpret the data. The head of the Illinois Department of Health said that a person who dies of a known non-COVID condition but has COVID diagnosis is called a COVID death. Now, just a few more words about masks. The World Health Organization says there's no evidence that universal masking protects. It also lists harms and critical risks, including difficulty breathing, self-contamination, and a false sense of security. In 2015, a randomized clinical trial found medical masks allow 44% penetration by viruses, and cloth masks allow 97% of virus particles to penetrate. And while boxes of medical masks warn that they don't protect against viruses, the FDA also prohibits manufacturers of non-medical masks from saying that they are safe or effective or for antiviral protection. Finally, two scientists writing on the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease website say masks are not effective as source control or PPE. Now, in conclusion, from our perspective, the mask mandate has been a social experiment infringing on the rights of individuals to speak and breathe freely. The mask mandate has also caused fear and social isolation, likely leading to the increased suicides and unnecessary and untimely non-COVID deaths. It's time to end this unnecessary and unproven mandate, not to codify it. Thanks so much for your attention.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Braze. And I should note that Ms. Braze gave us written testimony as well, which I think has been sent out to members. So, you know, I apologize to everyone that we don't have more time, but Ms. Braze has testified a lot and she knows how this works. So thank you.
Thank you.
We have Tom Kramer. Welcome, Mr. Kramer. Please introduce yourself and just tell us if you're affiliated with anybody or if you're just here on your own.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, my name is Tom Kramer. I'm a med tech design engineer representing myself, but part of a constituency that's always supported things like environmental protection, equal rights, and protecting the lower middle classes historically. My appeal to this bill today is aimed at one main thing, and that's common sense. Common sense in nature, the body needs to exhale. Exhalation is such an important part of our body's health. Blocking that is bad. Rebreathing things that your body needs to expel doesn't make things better, it makes things worse. The immune system needs to encounter germs to strengthen itself. Blocking this with unnatural means does not make things better, it makes it worse. And it's not working. This was supposed to last a few weeks. We're getting on to a year now. How long are we gonna do the same thing over and over and expect a different result? Common sense in the sense of health, a damp cloth soaked with bacteria and pathogens getting touched all day long does not make things better, it makes things worse. Oxygen is so important to our body. Look at what professional athletes have done with breathe right strips, tiny amounts of oxygen boosting performance. Preventing this from happening to people who are at health risk and have comorbidities does not make sense. Keeping our bodies strong and our immune systems with the ability to fight is a good way to do this. Blocking your body's natural ability to do that with unnatural means does not make things better. It makes things worse. Common sense from a social sense, this cannot go on forever. We have a double-edged problem here. Sheltering and distancing has extended the time that this virus has been going around, and masking has kept the spread high. This combination will make this last forever and give us no hope. Punishing the healthy while they're at risk with comorbidities are having their immune system and their health blocked by unhealthy and unnatural means does not make things better. It makes things worse. I don't want my grandkids having their social development stunted by growing up not recognizing facial expressions. Now, our leaders have been losing us over time, but this bill will put the final nail in the coffin as many of us will have lost faith in our longtime leaders and be gone forever. With this bill, common sense has gone out the window. You're focusing on the wrong things, interpreting data incorrectly, and this bill confirms the state's position is out of touch with real health. And I would just add that if I had a half hour to be in the room with all of the people who presented data and experiments today, I would be able to show how their data is irrelevant and being interpreted incorrectly. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much, Mr. Kramer. So members, are there questions? I haven't seen any come in, but are there questions for any of these testifiers? So want to have an opportunity if anyone does want to ask them questions. Just please raise your hand, and I think I will see them. And I'm not seeing any questions. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, testifiers. We appreciate your time. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we're going to move on to our next set of testifiers who are testifiers in support. And the first one is Dr. Beth Thielen from mHealth. Dr. Thielen, if you're here, welcome. If you could just introduce yourself, who you're with, and go ahead and give us your testimony. And you are muted, Dr. Thielen.
Hello.
Hi.
Dr. Beth Thielen, I'm going to put my mask in place because I'm working and in a healthcare setting where it's shared for other individuals. For safety, I'm going to be wearing my mask. So I'm an assistant professor of pediatrics in pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Minnesota. I'm also an infectious diseases physician for mHealth Fairview, and I run a research lab that studies respiratory viral infections. I'm speaking on behalf of myself, however, today. I'd like to address kind of two key points regarding masks. One, that masks are a critical piece of a multifaceted approach to COVID management. So I think as many of the other speakers have illustrated, they alone are not the sole solution to preventing COVID transmission, but they're a very key part. There's been multiple lines of evidence from different observational studies that have demonstrated reduced rates of SARS-CoV-2 transmission when masks are deployed. And I think despite kind of the tenor of the prior discussions, I think this is not a question amongst healthcare providers working in hospitals, whether this is effective. So we routinely use masks as part of infection prevention against not just SARS-CoV-2, but influenza and RSV and measles and chickenpox and tuberculosis and any number of infections. These are a widely accepted prevention strategy for preventing respiratory transmission. And so I think all the more important now that as we're seeing the variants emerge and as our health department has been a leader in identifying these variants that show some early signs of increased transmissibility. So I think all the more time to double down on our prevention measures that we know work. They're part of a solution in addition to ongoing distancing, regular testing programs, and hopefully the rollout of vaccination. So I don't see any of these as mutually exclusive, but part of a paired strategy to really continue to drive down our numbers in Minnesota and save the lives of many Minnesotans. I'd also like to speak to the safety issue. So again, I can speak as a healthcare professional who routinely wears masks as part of my job duties, that these are safe. They do not, I have asthma, and this is, I do not have concerns that these increase my risk of infections, as Dr. Griffiths really nicely articulated. I think they do allow passage of small air molecules like carbon dioxide and oxygen, so that is not a typical concern for the kinds of surgical masks and cloth masks that most people are wearing out in the community. And I think, in fact, the data have shown that there's actually been reduced transmission of a number of common infections probably because of the precautions that we're taking for COVID. So in terms of disease data in children, we are actually seeing many fewer cases and hospitalizations for things like respiratory syncytial virus, influenza, pneumonia, ear infections. These common childhood infections are actually less common because of these precautions. So I would like to push back a little against the idea that this is actually increasing the risk of children. In fact, we've actually been seeing quite the opposite. And I'm currently working in our children's hospital, so I have a very firsthand look at what the disease burden has been and have been in practice throughout the pandemic caring for both adult and child patients. So, those were all my comments for today, but happy to answer additional questions, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Dr. Thiel. And if you can hang around till the end of these next few testifiers in case there are questions, that'd be wonderful. Dr. Berkowitz, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz, and I'm a pediatrician and also the president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, a group of almost 1,000 pediatricians across the state with the mission of protecting and advancing the health of every child and adolescent in Minnesota. I'm here to speak in support of H.R. 604. As a pediatrician, my immediate goal is to take care of the child in front of me that day. Public health, on the other hand, is designed to protect and improve the health of people in their communities. This is important since it is at the core of this bill. Physicians are taught early in our education to first do no harm. We're also taught to look at how our actions will either benefit or harm our patients. In the case of the current COVID-19 pandemic, much is still to be learned about how best to control it and lessen the impact on our population. What is known and has been shown in the recent decline in our state's rate of infection is that masking, social distancing, and hand washing can help to reduce the spread and impact of the virus without causing any harm to the individual. A recent report in the Lancet Journal and available on the CDC COVID website discussed how even a 10% increase in mask use can significantly help control community transmission of the virus. It also showed that statewide mask mandates lead to increased mask usage. Mask use in people who've had influenza or the common cold has long been known to reduce transmission, and the same is now known for COVID-19. There is also good data to support that wearing a mask reduces the risk of an infected individual getting infected from someone else. Physicians are used to wearing masks when we enter a patient's room, both to keep ourselves from getting infected or potentially infecting the patient and or their family if we might have a very slight cold. Masks are an important part of the current public health strategy to get the COVID-19 pandemic under control. Our children and youth younger than 16 years old cannot currently receive vaccines, so it is important that everyone do everything we can to protect them, not just parents and grandparents, but everyone in the community. There have already been over 75,000 children and youth younger than 20 years old who have been infected with COVID-19 in Minnesota. Instead of simply being a public health strategy, wearing or not wearing masks has become a symbol. This strategy is no different than laws that prohibit driving while intoxicated, which not only protect the intoxicated driver from being hurt, but also others in the community from being injured by the driver. We all want to see our children and youth kept healthy and ultimately be able to return to in-person schooling when it is safe. Continuing to wear masks until it is safe to not wear them, as this bill proposes, is the correct path to take. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Berkowitz. Appreciate your testimony. Marilyn Pietzo? Sorry. Welcome.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, my name is Marilyn Pietzo. I practice pediatrics in St. Cloud. I'm a pediatric hospitalist, and I'm also president of the Minnesota Medical Association. We have over 10,000 members around the state. The MMA supports House File 604. In June of 2020, the MMA and 20 other state medical societies urged public and private leaders across the state to require the use of face coverings to help control the spread of COVID-19. Minnesota at that time was seeing improvements in the virus numbers, but the threat of the virus was far from over, and something needed to be done to ensure that our ICUs did not exceed capacity and to better position Minnesota to control the pandemic. The next month in July, with Executive Order 20-81, Governor Walz required all Minnesotans to wear face coverings in indoor public places and businesses, and we applauded the governor's leadership. Wearing a face covering is critical in the fight against COVID-19, a tool that helps reduce the spread of the disease, particularly when used universally. The medical benefits are clear, as we've been hearing all afternoon. A face covering helps reduce virus transmission by those who are infected with or without symptoms. It provides a barrier that keeps respiratory droplets from spreading. By wearing a face covering, you protect yourself and others. There's no greater public health measure that we can all be a part of. I fear that with COVID-19 vaccines, many might begin to let down their guard. It is imperative that the use of face coverings continue even after vaccination. There are still many unknowns with COVID-19, and continued use of face coverings will be necessary to prevent the spread of the virus, to protect those with compromised immune systems, and reduce the risk of contracting other strains. We have a responsibility to protect ourselves, our families, and our communities. Passage of House File 604 will allow the legislature to send a strong message that face coverings will be used universally to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. And just as a personal aside, I am a senior citizen, still working actively as a pediatric hospitalist. I feel very well protected with my mask, and the vast majority of workers in medical settings with the use of masks are able to avoid being infected even when around people with active infections. So just an anecdotal addition. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pietzo. We appreciate your testimony. We have Mary Turner. Welcome.
There you go. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
My name is Mary Turner, and I'm president of Minnesota Nurses Association. But more importantly, I'm a COVID ICU nurse at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. And I've been on the front lines since last February 2020. I'm here today on behalf of 22,000 bedside nurses who work in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and North Dakota. I'm here to speak in support of the House File 604. The fact that Minnesotans are beginning to get vaccinated in large numbers is something worth celebrating. But evidence from other parts of the country and the world show us that even with vaccinations, we cannot let our guard down in terms of continuing to slow the spread of this virus. The Minnesota Nurses Association firmly supports policies of mandatory masks and face coverings as a necessary measure to protect the public and stave off the resurgence of COVID-19 virus that has ravaged the state since March of last year. Our board of directors voted to support policies like this and urge lawmakers at every level to enact mandatory mask orders and ordinance statewide. Nurses support policies requiring the use of cloth face coverings for the following reasons. One, when used in the context of broader health, public health response, policies requiring the use of cloth face coverings can help slow the transmission of the virus that causes COVID-19. Two, asymptomatic transmission is a significant concern in how rapidly and easily this virus that causes COVID-19 spreads in the communities. Mandatory use of those who can wear face coverings can reduce asymptomatic transmissions. For nurses, this is not only an issue of keeping people health and safety and safe. It is also an issue of having the proper resources to care for people who do get sick. Our hospitals at times have been short on personal protective equipment, hospital beds, and staff since the beginning of the pandemic. And anything that can keep people from getting sick and not having to go to the hospital helps provide better care to those who do end up having to go to the hospital. And as a side note, if you any of you got the paper this past weekend, there was a almost a five-page spread article about the my floor, South 7, the COVID unit. It was very well done, but what it did demonstrate is, you know, to myself and the other nurses working on that floor, the concept of personal freedom totally takes a back seat to the pain and suffering that we have seen this past year. There is no comparison to what we've had to watch, and many of us have not only been dealing with our patients, but we've had our only own family members that have passed away from COVID. My father was a casualty at the very beginning. And in this article, a nurse tells about how she feels guilty because they did family gathering. They thought the numbers were down. They could gather together, and her mother-in-law ended up passing away. And Holly mentions that in that article. So not only are we seeing the worst case scenarios of this vicious virus, but I'm so happy that it got put out there because people need to know this is real. People need to know that this is not something you easily get over. And I just want emphasize that we also think it is so important to do all the other things, like the stay-at-home orders and the distancing policies and the workplace protections and everything else like that, the paid sick leave, the family leave policies, getting tested for COVID, you know, getting healthcare workers and other frontline workers tested for COVID-19. I apologize if I get emotional about this, but you just can't imagine the war that's been going on out there. And I've been a frontline witness to it. And we have a way to stop it. And we need to do that. We need to support House File 604. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Turner. Thank you. Thank you for your work and for the work of all your colleagues who are on the front lines. Really, thank you. Dr. Rajesh Prabhu, I hope I'm saying it correctly.
Yes,
welcome.
Hi. Hi. Rajesh Prabhu. I'm an infectious disease physician at Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota, and here to talk about why I support universal masking. My understanding is, or my impression has been, that COVID is very unpredictable. I mean, you hear about, the elderly having a higher death rate, but any decade of life could have a bad outcome, including death. So your age and your health, young age, good health does not guarantee that you'll have a good outcome from COVID. Fortunately, that most people that get COVID do recover from it, but I've seen quite a few people with COVID in the hospital. And even those that survive, it's not just like getting over the common cold. I mean, they are sick for months. Some are permanently or long-term have ill effects. And I would use that as an analogy for West Nile virus when it went through Minnesota, or even Lyme disease. I think people have heard of people that have had those type of infections that never quite feel normal after their illness. And COVID is just another infection to that long list of infections that could potentially give a person permanent damage. But you don't know until after the fact if you're going to have a very easy recovery, a long-term recovery, or death. And with COVID, there's just been such an unprecedented amount of research into COVID worldwide. Prior to COVID, there wasn't much research on the transmissibility of viral infections or the protective nature of masks, whether it's medical grade or cotton mask. There was a lot of kind of indirect evidence, but only after COVID hit that really people paid attention. And then Dr. Hogan had presented some data from the Mayo Clinic. There's many studies, many institutions around the world have done similar experimental models showing how masking itself really cuts down the transmission risk. But the key thing is that masking works if both parties mask. That's where your greatest benefit is. So if you went to a voluntary system, I guess choose to mask to protect myself, the greatest benefit is actually when both parties mask, whether it's a cotton mask or surgical mask or a higher medical grade mask. And as you know, that we do universal masking and eye protection. And someone had asked earlier about eye protection. They have looked at that. There is an added benefit of eye protection in reducing your risk of getting this coronavirus infection. So our rates of infection of healthcare workers, if you follow the appropriate personal protective equipment, is actually probably lower than in the community. And the other point is that even prior to COVID, like influenza, we've heard that you can pass the flu prior to getting symptoms. There was really indirect evidence. With COVID, it's unbelievable how much research and attention has been to determine that you can truly transmit COVID prior to symptom development. So that's 2 days before. You're most contagious 2 days before and probably 5 to 6 days after symptoms develop. So that first week of infection is the most critical to prevent transmission to others.
All right, Dr. Prabhu, thank you so much. So members, it's 5:08. We were going to end at 5:30, but I do want to allow some brief questions if you have them, because we do have some amendments to handle. So Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, appreciate everybody that took the time to be with us today and testify and give us the benefit of your knowledge, of your experience, of your training, of your life work, basically, that puts you in a position to make these very educated, very professional, very credible statements about the value of wearing masks. And so thank you again for doing that, each of you. And And I just thank you, Ms. Turner, for sharing with you also that emotional impact that this all has so that we know what's involved and what the stakes are. And it takes a lot of strength to be able to speak that honestly in this kind of setting. So thank you. My question goes back to Dr. Teal. So a couple things as we're looking on you on Zoom here, you are wearing a mask, and I think we refer to that as like a surgical mask. And so people have said, like, well, if it's not an N95 or the equivalent of a 95, it's not worth wearing. But you are in a hospital setting, you're a provider, and that's not what you're wearing right now. So could you, talk about how you see masking and different masks in different situations? Thank you.
Yeah,
Dr. Thielen.
Thank you for that question. Yes, so I am in a hospital, and we have very specific guidance on under what circumstances we are to wear surgical masks versus N95s. And certainly as part of my day, I do use an N95, and those are typically when we are performing procedures or in a space where there is a patient receiving a procedure where there are aerosols being generated. So it's a risk-benefit analysis where our infection preventionists who do this kind of work day in and day out of figuring out what are the occupational exposures that are most at risk, they have made a choice about when the highest risk procedures happen. And so that might be suctioning a patient or obtaining a sputum sample where somebody's coughing something up or putting a breathing tube in a patient's airway. Those are higher risk procedures. And under those conditions, I would be wearing an N95 when I'm wearing, if I'm in a room with a patient even that is known to be COVID positive, I would be wearing an N95. But this mask is what I wear. It's on in the morning when I walk in the door, and it's on my face every moment of the day, except when I'm eating or drinking throughout the day. And that is both to protect me from getting transmission, but also if I were to be an asymptomatic carrier, prevent me from transmitting to my patients. And so that has been part of our standard protocol in the hospital, that we are all wearing surgical masks all the time when we're just going about our business and with non-COVID infected patients. And we amp up those precautions when we are in fact doing higher risk procedures. Normally when I'm seeing a patient, I am also wearing a face shield. So the previous provider talked about that. I have my face shield right here. I'm not wearing it since I'm in this room by myself, but that is also part of my routine protection that I wear all the time.
Thank you, Representative Pryor.
Very short follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you. And also, even after providers are vaccinated, is the policy to continue to wear masks in the hospital setting?
Dr. Thielen.
Thank you for that question. Yes, so for right now, that is the guidance, and that stems from the fact that we don't yet know to what extent the vaccines prevent asymptomatic transmission. And so that is, as long as that is a concern until we have better evidence addressing that specific question, yes, my understanding is that will be the guidance for the time being.
All right, well, thank you so much. Representative Grunhagen, and then we're gonna move on to take some amendments. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you for extending the time. This is a very important issue. And I have a question for the testifiers. I first want to thank Mrs. Turner for what she does on that floor. You know, about when I was 54, I was hospitalized for 10 days, and I think my nurse was an angel. In fact, I accused her of being an angel several times, although she wouldn't show me her wings. So I know what she does is very important. I appreciate her testimony. But I do have a personal story. Both my wife and I had COVID back in November. I was over it in about 48 hours, like a 48-hour flu. But my wife got very sick. She went to the doctor. They gave her prednisone and sent her home. Well, she took the prednisone for 3 or 4 days, and it did seem to help some. But then once it was gone, the COVID got worse. In fact, it got to the point where she had a hard time breathing. Yet we didn't see, they didn't want to admit her to the hospital. So she went online to some doctors and explained her circumstances, who prescribed her hydroxychloroquine and CPAC. Okay, we picked it up the next day at the local drugstore. She started taking that. 3-4 days later, she was better. Okay, and this is where she was at the point where she had a hard time breathing. All right, so my question to the testifiers is, since wouldn't it make sense to give our most vulnerable population, where we have 70% of the deaths, preventative medication like hydroxychloroquine and certain vitamins were also recommended by these doctors? You can find them on the internet. There's several medical experts that say prevention for our most vulnerable should be done. You shouldn't wait till you get sick to the point where you have to be hospitalized. And yet it isn't just my wife. I've had, and I'm a lay person, not a doctor, okay? But I've had several of my clients in my insurance industry tell me the same thing. Little was done until they had to be hospitalized. Why don't we practice prevention? Hydroxychloroquine can be sold over the counter without a prescription in Africa for malaria. It's been around for over 50 years. So I'd like you to respond to that, one of the testifiers. Thank you.
Okay, so Representative Gunhagen, this whole bill is about prevention. But I'm not sure which of you, Dr. Thielen, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative Gruenhagen. So I think you've raised a really important point that we've been hearing about from the beginning. And I think there was definitely a lot of early interest about whether hydroxychloroquine and some of the drugs you mentioned might prevent COVID. But in fact, we now actually have really good answers that show that, in fact, that is not the case. So that has been studied in multiple trials now, including some investigators, including Dr. Bulwer at our University of Minnesota institution, have been instrumental in conducting some of those studies. And we now have very clear scientific answers that particular treatment is not effective for prevention. However, we do have other therapies, including monoclonal antibodies, that we are deploying for prevention strategies in exposed and infected individuals as part of our overall package. And I don't want to diminish the importance of those, but I think we can even act upstream even farther by preventing people from getting infected in the first place. And I think for those of us who are sort of thinking about public health and how we cause the least harm and have the most benefit, we really are trying to get upstream and avoid even exposing people to treatments or having to come into a hospital to get treatment for an already acquired infection and if ever possible, prevent infection from happening in the first place.
Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen, please go ahead.
I just think I see a lack of trying to treat people with things. Certain vitamins, too, have been recommended by medical experts. You know, my wife was getting very sick, and she got hydroxychloroquine and Z-Pak, and boom, just in 2 to 3 days, she was better. So, I mean, that's personal experience. And the doctors who prescribed it said this will work, and it did. Now, I'm not saying there aren't other ones, but I think we need to emphasize prevention with people, not with masks, but with actual treatments that will help prevent them from getting the infection. And it seems like some of the medical community is waiting for people to get so sick before they do anything and then stick them in the hospital. They should be doing something ahead of time, especially for the most vulnerable. I know it got a little long, but thank you, Madam Chair.
No, thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. First of all, I wasn't aware that you'd been through this and that your wife had, and I certainly, you know, wish her and you all the best in dealing with it. Prevention, we are vaccinating people, that's prevention, and trying to keep people from contracting this disease. So did any of our testifiers want to respond to that last piece further, Dr. Berkowitz?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify one thing. There's a difference between prevention when you mean keeping somebody from ever getting infected, and that's really where the vaccine is going to be most effective, and prevention when you're talking about preventing somebody who's already infected from getting worse. And I think those are two different topics. I think Dr. Dillon already talked about use of monoclonal antibodies to prevent somebody who's infected from getting worse. I think the other thing I would just say is that what the representative is really talking about is anecdotal evidence. His wife got better after getting something. Other people have gotten it after other people. What we're really trying to focus on is what science is showing, what studies have shown when they've looked at large groups, whether it's vitamins, whether it's hydroxyquinolone or others. And if the science is not supporting that they're effective, then we shouldn't be recommending them for anybody. Thank you. Yeah,
science is
all right.
By experts. That's the problem.
Well, okay. So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Berkowitz. Okay. Well, really appreciate all of the testifiers being here today. And thank you again for being here and for your testimony. So members, we're going to move on. We really only have 10 minutes left in the hearing. I've been told that we have a number of amendments, and I'm going to take the first ones in the order in which I've been told that the minority would want to take them. So the first amendment that I'm aware of here is the A1, and Representative Damuth, is that yours?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Yes, this is my amendment, the A1.
Okay, so Representative Damuth moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to describe your amendment?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you to the testifiers and everything that we've heard in this committee hearing so far today. My amendment is fairly simple. It would improve the bill as proposed, and it is an amendment that would expand the bill's allowance for masks to be removed during sports. The bill currently only allows for masks to be removed when playing college or pro sports, but by making this change, we would allow for masks to be removed during the youth sports as well. We've all heard from parents and kids in our districts asking for us to allow kids to play sports without masks. We know the World Health Organization does not recommend wearing a mask during exercise because it could create difficulties with breathing. The CDC also says that people who are engaged in high-intensity activities like running may not be able to wear a mask if it causes the difficulty in breathing. Yet this bill would require our youth athletes in Minnesota to wear a mask. Are we listening to the experts and listening to the science? The science doesn't say that collegiate and professional athletes are somehow safer from COVID. So let's give all Minnesotans playing sports the same leeway to remove their masks. And Madam Chair, I would request a roll call on this.
All right, a roll call having been requested. Representative Hewitt, discussion.
Yes, Madam Chair.
To the amendment.
Yep, yes, Madam Chair, and I'm gonna speak in opposition to the amendment. Currently I'm in my referee outfit, ready to go to a game here. And I've been observing this since football started as a referee. The ones that complain the most are the parents. The kids have adapted. As a EMT, I watch the kids when they're out on the floor. I have not had to stop a game once this season to...
Representative Hewitt, I think we might have lost you there.
On this one here, I think we got to take the precautions, and our kids have to stay in the mask. I would oppose this amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think maybe I have a question for Ms. Clarkvist from House Research. I was just looking at the author's amendment, and it looks like it deleted page 3, lines 16 and 17, which are the two lines that this amendment would modify. I'm just wondering if this amendment is in order with the adoption of the author's amendment.
Ms. Clarkvist?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg, if this amendment were to be adopted, I would ask for a direction from the chair to make any technical changes to the amendment needed to allow the goal of the amendment to be effectuated. Higher education institution sport. The term higher education institution is no longer used. It's intercollegiate sport. So I think that what I would do is remove intercollegiate sport or professional instead of higher education institution.
Okay, thank you. So it's just a technical problem and not one that the, in other words, the amendment is still relevant. Okay, let's see. Next we have Representative Keel.
Madam Chair, I would speak in support of this. I heard Representative Hewitt talk about how he's seen all kinds of students. I do have school board members calling. Kids are passing out. One got a concussion. There's been some different issues out there. So I believe that Representative Damuth's
amendment would be very important to our local schools and making sure that our students are allowed to play without masks and best for them. Thank you.
Okay, I see that Representative Backer's hand is up. Representative Backer.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I received an email from a coach in my district. I actually served with her as an EMT on our ambulance service. And what's happening in a nutshell is, especially with small teams, they only have 6 or 7 people on the team. So they just don't have the number of kids. So they're getting tired. They're pulling the mask down. Just like we had one testifier showing the bacteria that's getting in there. They're touching the ball. They're taking breaths. And it's not a good thing for them. So I like this amendment. That's what I'll say. I could spend a whole hour on this, but I will save everybody on that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. So I'm going to ask Mr. Huff to comment, and then we'll go to Representative Jordan for the last word. Mr. Huff, did you want to say anything about the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. We oppose this amendment. I think, especially referring back to our testifiers, I think Dr. Griffith's testimony was very important. There are no contraindications for mask wearing during sports. Now, we have been tracking sports-related injuries that might be associated with mask wearing. We have heard anecdotally of kids being out of breath, dizzy. However, I would say that, you know, after Christmas break, I know when my son was a wrestler, he would definitely feel that way when he's doing his sprints to get back into shape after Christmas. But we have no indication that that is related to the masking. Now, as far as injuries, we are working very closely with the various sports bodies, the Minnesota High School League, as well as different associations. Right now, we have 3 injuries that have been reported either through these bodies or to MDH. We have 1 concussion that was reported to the High School League. That concussion may or may not have been to mask obstruction of vision. We have another concussion that was reported to the Minnesota Hockey as well as to MDH. Both Minnesota Hockey and MDH spoke with the parent, but the parent declined whether the child received medical attention. The parent did say that it was a mask obstruction. We also have another report to MDH of a fall during basketball with leg bruising. However, if we look at the number of injuries that have been reported so far, and we've been working very closely with these various sports associations, they do not see an increase or really any difference between this season and other seasons that have been without masking. So we are definitely tracking because we want to make sure that we're not doing anything that might injure children's health. But right now we have not seen anything that would indicate that's statistically significant or out of the norm. Our guidance is based upon actually the CDC does suggest that masking is used when in athletics, based upon the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance, and I think Dr. Griffith said it well, that there really is not an issue with respiration with masking, but masking is very important in protecting each other, protecting our kids, as well as protecting their families. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Huff. And then just quickly, because, we're going to run a little bit past 5:30. I'd like to be able to take up at least one more amendment before we lay the bill over. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Dr. Griffith's pre-presentation earlier really shows why this amendment needs more work before it's attached to the bill. I know Representative Damuth has a strong interest in youth athletics, and I'd be happy to work with her on that. But at this time, I urge a no vote on this amendment.
All right, thank you. The clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Chair Liebling.
No.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
No.
Hewitt, no. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Nay.
Bonner, nay. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, no.
Bierman, nay. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, no.
Bolden, nay. Representative Dameth.
Dameth, aye.
Dameth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
No.
Freiberg, nay. Representative Grünhagen.
Aye.
Grünhagen, aye. Representative Kiel.
Yes.
Aye.
Kiel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, no.
Morrison, no. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
No.
Pryor, no. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
No.
Ryer, no. Representative Schultz.
No.
Schultz, no. Representative Wolgamott. Wolgamott, no. 8 ayes and 11 nays.
So the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. On the next one, we'll take up and again request of the minority, but I'm getting from staff, so I hope this is correct, but the A10. And that would be Representative Ackland. And then members, after this one, we're going to have to lay the bill over because we're out of time. Representative Ackland, did you want to move the A10?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So Representative Ackland moves the A10 amendment. Please go ahead and present the amendment.
Okay. This amendment addresses one of the biggest issues that I see with this bill. As it is written, it will essentially never end. The bill says the mask mandate will only go away if the CDC says that masks are not an effective way to prevent the spread of COVID. This means that long after the COVID pandemic is over, unless the CDC says masks are not effective at preventing COVID spread, Minnesotans would need to wear masks. As a retired nurse of 40 years, I know that masks work in stopping the spread of certain diseases. It's important that we continue to wear masks and practice social distancing to prevent the spread of COVID. However, this bill needs an end date. We need an end date that reflects the progress we are making here in Minnesota to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The amendment fixes this major issue. Instead of an endless mask mandate, we would end the mandate when the state reaches herd immunity, which experts say is around 80% of the state having immunity. At our current pace of vaccinations, we are set to reach this mark in November. However, we all expect that increased production and new vaccines being created will speed up this process. The amendment says that once we have herd immunity and we no longer need to worry about community spread, we should end this mandate. Minnesotans do not need to live in fear forever. In fact, they need hope. They need hope that this pandemic will eventually end and things will return to normal. This amendment ensures things will actually return to normal sooner than never. I would request a roll call, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, a roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. We have a list of members. Representative Bolden. I have Bolden, Freiberg, Morrison, and I see Backer now as well. So, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am speaking in opposition to this amendment, and the piece I would like to just call attention to is the definition or the way the amendment is defining that 80% herd immunity. That is including not only folks who have been vaccinated, but folks who have had COVID-19. And that just is not in alignment with what science is telling us. There is not evidence to show. We don't know that folks who have had COVID-19, are not able to get it again or have that immunity. So, the recommendation from experts right now is even for folks who have had COVID-19, they should still get vaccinated. And so I think we need to follow the science on this. We all would like COVID to be over and move, past this as soon as possible. And, masking and vaccines and all of the safety, items that we have talked about are a way to do this. But we need to keep doing all of these things until we are past it. And so though we are tired of COVID, COVID is not done with us. So I would speak in opposition of this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Auckland, we don't respond. Well, you could, but we have a lot of questions.
This is just a very specific thing to what she said.
Okay, please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I had looked up online and I have a quote from mayoclinic.org who said there are two ways to achieve herd immunity. Either a large proportion of the population gets infected or they get a protective vaccine. So just a point of clarification. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I guess I would be interested to know if that quote is specific to COVID-19 or if it's just a more general statement about herd immunity, because I just did a quick Google search and I found let me back up. The way this amendment is phrased, this just piggybacks on what Representative Bolden said, is that the requirements for wearing a mask will end when the earlier of two things happen. First is an arbitrary date of January 1st, 2022, and we don't know what the situation on the ground will be like at that point, or a determination that 80% of people have either received a COVID vaccine or have tested positive for COVID-19. And that second part is also a problem for me. I mean, it suggests that there is no, that once you get COVID-19, then you're completely immune. And I just did a quick Google search and I found an article from Scientific American that says why the U.S. is underestimating COVID reinfection. I found an article from WebMD that says study young COVID survivors can get reinfected. So, I think this is a kind of a poorly drafted amendment that doesn't reflect what could be happening on the ground, either with the arbitrary date or by just kind of soft pedaling the risk of reinfection, which I think is a real risk out there. So I will not be supporting it.
Okay, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you, Representative Ackland. I appreciate what you're trying to do with this amendment. Boy, I want this to be over too. And we will get there. But I also want to just take a moment to thank the medical professionals who testified in front of the committee today. Incredibly grateful for the work that they have done over this past year. And I'm grateful to my fellow docs, but boy, I am really grateful to the nurses, like Mary Turner, like Representative Bolden, who spend the most time with patients at the bedside. And you could hear the emotion in her voice reflecting her experience on lines over this past year. It has been grueling. And this is something that we can all do to protect each other. I'll echo what Representative Bolden said primarily, that there's a lot we still do not know about the novel coronavirus. And there is some concerning evidence about reinfection emerging. And so to count on past infection with the virus is not adequate to determine what is herd immunity. So I will not be supporting the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Backer, then Representative Quam. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair members. I support this amendment. As a medical volunteer profession, as an EMT for 25 years, I've had the situation I've been put in the back of the ambulance with individuals, some known to have COVID, others not. We as leaders need to follow the science, and like Representative Ackland has shared, is that at our current pace, 80% immunity with herd, with the vaccines or people getting the virus is a reasonable and attainable by November. What really concerns me with a lot of our testifiers, especially last week, is everything is doom or gloom. I think it's our responsibility to say, hey, we have a plan. We're working forward with the plan with science, instead of hearing statements like the darkest days are ahead of us. We've had leaders in the past who have not taken that approach with other things in our history. I think that's wise. So I think Representative Ackland's amendment is reasonable, it's prudent, and we need to have an end in mind. And if we don't start doing that now with what we're doing, we've heard, well, when we get vaccine, we can do this. When we do this, we can get this. When we get this, and the carrot's always moving down the road with poor science. So I'm going to be supporting that. I do appreciate people listening. I do thank you for everybody's comments here. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
All right, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's not trivial to do a mandate. And frankly, one nice thing about having an end date is that we are forced to reevaluate the data and the information. A year ago, we were hearing a lot of things, and then we developed treatments. We've got vaccines. Things have changed and improved. In 3 months from now, we'll have a better idea just how effective. Probably we'll have four vaccines that will be being utilized. And frankly, putting something on autopilot like this, I think, is abdicating our need to keep up to date, revisit, and appropriately adjust something as important as a mandate. So I'm going to wholeheartedly support this amendment. And if there can be improvement and tweaking before, since it's being laid on the table, I think we should really look at how we can do a better job with this bill and the fact that we haven't been able to debate and talk about other amendments because we ran out of time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I would like to go to MDH for briefly, and I think that Dr. Linfield is here. I think Madam Dr. Chair? Huff had to, Representative Ackland.
I have one last say. Is that maybe when on amendments you don't, but I did have some information, factual information to share.
Okay. we're way past our time to adjourn. If we go too much longer, we're just going to lay the bill on the table and not get to a vote. So
1 minute.
Go ahead.
Okay. So a couple things. One, per the CDC, confirmed and suspected cases of reinfection have been reported, but this is rare. So we don't base our decisions around the outliers, the rareness of it. Secondly, there are two ways to achieve herd immunity. Like I said before, either from getting the infection or the vaccine. Experts estimate that in the United States, 70% of the population, more than 200 people, would have to recover from COVID-19 to halt the epidemic. So that's from Mayo Clinic saying, yes, we can achieve herd immunity if just by doing that. And also, the herd immunity, immunity to disease varies from disease to disease. But in the SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, if it's like other coronaviruses that currently infect humans, we can expect that people who get infected will be immune for months to years, but probably not for their entire lives. So I think we have to take the fact that our vaccine works and move forward from that in being able to open up our communities back to a more normal state. So thank you. Thank you for my
okay. Okay. All right. We have, is Dr. Linfield here? Okay, I think she had wanted to comment, but I don't see her. Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Ackland, for bringing this amendment forward. I think you get at a really good point. And a part of why this bill has been really difficult to write, this is, you know, a bill that where we've been talking about as legislature, as legislators, we want to do our job. We want to craft policy. We don't want necessarily one person making all these policies. So this is an example of something that we need to work on. And sunset date is something that I would like. It was maybe the part of the bill that was the most difficult to figure out. And in talking to many researchers, they struggled with this too. And I think that's why this is a really hard thing for our legislature to figure out. And I'm in the position of agreeing with Representative Quam, where we need to have more discussions about this. So I hope you will come to me with these ideas, because I think there's quite a bit that we need to figure out, including how, you know, these new variants are affecting our disease, our vaccine efficacy, what definition of herd immunity we want to go by, who's in charge of making these decisions. So this is definitely a subject of the area of the bill that I know needs work, something that I think everyone on this Zoom meeting knows needs work. So I'm hoping you'll come to me with some of your ideas and we can work on this. At this time, I don't know that this amendment is in the shape that it should be to be attached to the bill. And so I do urge a no vote tonight. But Representative Ackland, I also urge you to come and talk to me about this and we'll figure something out.
Thank you. I'll do that.
Great. And I think there's Dr. Linfield. I know she had some audio problems. Dr. Linfield, did you want to comment on the amendment?
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair.
And you might need to introduce yourself. I don't think that you
yes,
have
absolutely. Call. I'm so sorry. My name's Ruth Linfield. I am the state epidemiologist and the medical director at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm also board certified in pediatric infectious diseases and have worked at the Minnesota Department of Health for more than 20 years. One thing I do want to say about SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, is we are always learning more about it. And as Representative Ackland said, we do not think that immunity is long-lasting. It is the case, she had mentioned months to years. This is distinctly different than a disease like measles, where we think that once you have been infected or immunized and received the appropriate round of immunizations, immunity is lifelong. In fact, currently, we are seeing reinfections occur, particularly in the setting of variants. We have not had a lot of these very concerning variants in the United States, but certainly in Brazil, they had a big surge in the spring and summer of cases, and now they are seeing reinfections in people who have been previously infected. So there is a concern about immunity for these variants, and there is a concern about waning of protective immunity. And we also do not know how long protective immunity will last from the vaccine. And so the bottom line is the science is not quite there yet. I think that we need to keep an eye on the science. I believe that we will know more in the near future about the impact of these variants, as well as the length of protective immunity. But today we don't have those answers. I would suggest that the committee continue to think about this issue, and maybe we can craft language and help craft language. I certainly understand the need to have a sunset, but we want to make it appropriate for the science. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Linfield. So, I see Representative Freiberg has a hand up. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it super short. One thing I don't think we've actually said is that the bill, as it's drafted, actually has a sunset. It says sections 1 through 3 shall expire upon the issuance by the CDC of a guidance that does not include, basically when the CDC says there's no longer a need to wear face coverings. So there is actually a sunset in the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Freiberg. And, you know, I do think that's an important point because some of the people who've been writing to us think there's no sunset, and that, in fact, is not the case. There is a sunset in the bill. So, okay, so I know that Representative Ackland is new, and, you know, I think as Representative Jordan said, this is one of the sort of conundrums of putting this into law, is how do you write into law what the endpoint should be? And part of our problem that we have is that this is a novel coronavirus. We're still learning about it. The science is still evolving. We've got these very troubling variants coming that we've seen in other places have been really problematic. And so, if the legislature is successful in moving a bill and actually making this law and taking this away from the governor, which is what we've heard over and over, people don't want the governor making these decisions. We want to make it as a legislature. If we're successful in doing that, we need a policy that is going to be adaptable to the changing science of the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. So that's why I think that this is a problematic amendment. And it's sort of unfortunate that it has a roll call on it, which is, usually we don't do that as a rule in committee unless, somebody wants to force members to go on record on something and kind of draw the line. But be that as it may, I'm going to recommend a no vote to members as well, because this is really puts an arbitrary and possibly really inappropriate end date on the bill. And at this time, we just don't know. We can all hope very much that this is, that this would work. And, we all hope that this is over by January 1st, 2022. My goodness, nobody wants to go another day, much less another almost full year with this. But we also want to keep people alive and healthy and safe. And so, Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll.
Chair Liebling.
No.
Liebling, no. Vice Chair Hewitt.
No.
Hewitt, no. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, nay.
Bonner, no. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, no.
Bierman, no. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, no.
Bolden, no. Representative Damath.
Damath, aye.
Damath, aye. Representative Freiberg.
No.
Freiberg, no. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no. I'm sorry, change. Okay.
Grunhagen, aye.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Keel.
Representative Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, no.
Morrison, no. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, no.
Pryor, no. Representative Kwan.
Aye.
Kwan, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, no.
Ryer, no. Representative Schultz.
No.
Schultz, no. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, no.
Wolgamott, no. 8 ayes and 11 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. And with that, members, we're going to lay over the bill. Thank you very much for a good discussion and a good consideration. Thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing this to us. And so the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So with that, members, I'm going to let you go. I hope you've got something nice and relaxing planned for your evening after this very long meeting. And we will be hearing, we have a good meeting planned for tomorrow about Black maternal health, and we're going to be hearing House File 660. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.